Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You hear so much about disclosure, you know, we got to get the government to reveal the truth to us about UFOs. And really, as Keel pointed out, a lot of times we hid the truth from ourselves.
I'm talking with Brent Raines. Now, there are so many directions we can go with this, okay? So we have a book that he's written. The one I have is John Keel, The Man, the Myth, and the Ongoing Mysteries. But he's also had a magazine that's been out for years, all right? If you've missed this, Alternate Perceptions Magazine, it's online, with tons and tons of articles, information, all sorts of Fortean, paranormal, unexplained, UFO, the whole wide open field, and a lot of different articles and research. So we're going to start with this. Okay, this is Brent Raines, before I get ahead of myself, and the book John Keel, but also about the magazine. And we're going to start with, which I really love, John Keel, apparently, is his battle cry, because I'm not as familiar with John Keel. I wish I was. I'm catching up now. Thank you, thank you, thank you for all the breadcrumbs. Belief is the enemy. Brent, it's yours.
Well, John Keel strived to be, of course, an objective journalist, and he had traveled widely in, you know, the 1950s. He was a correspondent and journalist correspondent in Paris and in Germany and over in Spain and different, you know, stories. When he was in the army, beginning in the early 1950s, and he was assigned because of his early journalism career to radio station, military radio station that broadcast over in Europe, and he was in Frankfurt, Germany, and he did a lot of features and work for them. He had he loved travel so much that he did a thing on traveling in different places in Europe, and he also, to give a little background, he also covered stories like he spent a night in one of the large pyramids in Egypt. You know, mm-hmm. Live broadcast. Also, Frankenstein's Castle. He had he worked on a thing to have a live broadcast from there, and he had a journalist standing outside in the castle and had someone come up and, you know, spook him. Okay, so anyway,
he had a sense of humor.
He had a sense of humor. Yes, very much so. I loved it. He called it a tongue-in-cheek humor. You know, and Rosemary Galley, who knew him, said it was an acid wit that he had, and she really enjoyed his humor. And yet, he was also very serious about a lot of this. And when he got into the UFO paranormal investigations later in life, he really tried to do an extraordinary job and cover it as factually and objectively as he could. One of his statements became battle cries. You say the belief is the enemy, because a lot of times it kept investigators from being objective and doing a thorough and objective job and interpretation of the information they gathered. Not that, you know, that you hear so much about disclosure, you know, we got to get the government to reveal the truth to us about UFOs. And really, as Keel pointed out, a lot of times we hid the truth from ourselves, because if we were on an investigation, all we wanted was generally in the early 50s and 60s, a lot of the And he came along in 1966, deciding to investigate UFOs. And at that time, the major organizations like the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena in Washington, D.C., a civilian group that was operated by and founded by an ex-Marine by the name of Donald Kehoe. It was a very huge civilian group, but, you know, they didn't want people who had more than one sighting. They considered, well, they're probably seeing things after, you know, it was a once-in-a-lifetime event in their mind. Mm-hmm. And they weren't into the contact syndrome, the contacting experience, or the abduction experience. And so if someone reported a being coming out of it, that automatically got stuck way in the back of the files, or it never made it to the files, you know. And then, of course, Keel found out from his own field investigations, where he went out through about 20 different states interviewing people about their experiences traveling here and there, and discovered that a lot of people were having all these high strange crossover events and manifestations. You know, their poltergeist outbreaks after seeing a UFO or something, or cryptids. You know, if someone saw a Bigfoot or something, the average investigator would say in the UFO field at that time, this is not my field. Some still do it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And anything paranormal, well, that's not my field. You know, leave it to the ghost hunters or whatever. So,
when you're going through these files and looking what he has, and now going back over this and seeing how they parallel, and like if somebody had a UFO sighting, there was a paranormal thing that accompanied it. I had somebody question me about that about maybe even 5 years ago, saying, because we were just beginning, I think, in the last 10 years, 5 to 10 years, putting all of this into a greater category that included not just the nuts and bolts, but the stuff that happened after the sighting and the stuff that happened that originally, like you said, oh, that's the ghost hunters. It's like, no. There's something going on here. And he was ahead of the time. He was ahead of the curve on that.
Yeah. He talked about, you know, Ivan Sanderson, who was a good friend and colleague of his, who was a Scottish-born zoologist, very respected in the field, but he was also interested in the UFOs, the paranormal, the cryptid stuff as well. He wrote a book on Bigfoot back in the 50s, and a book, Invisible Residents, on UFO phenomenon. And they were actually going to write a book together, but they developed such different kind of perspectives, with Keel going, you know, in the direction he went.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Sanderson that came up with the term ultra-terrestrial, but Keel was the one who really ran with it. And to him, it was kind of like quantum physics and the electromagnetic spectrum and how the beings existed in a hidden reality, this interactive intelligence, whatever name you want to apply to it. But he decided instead of extraterrestrials, they were ultra-terrestrials. Because to me personally, as you know from watching a brief video that Dr. Greg Little, who works with me on Alternate Perceptions magazine and different things,
mm-hmm.
For a number of years, it doesn't really matter, because, you know, the people who are working like quantum physics and all the paranormal and quantum hoopla over non-local reality, I mean, it could be both. It could be one or the other. I mean, I'm not sure that it really is a significant point that we need to quarrel over. I mean, it's, you know, show signs of being an interactive intelligence, but whether it's extraterrestrial or ultra-terrestrial, you know, it's almost a moot point.
Well, and I don't know that we can even answer it from this vantage point. You know, you have to have, I guess, a greater awareness or sense of something concrete to be able to discern what the difference is.
Yeah, and the point is, though, that with Keel, we had to become multidisciplinary. You know, we had to be able to not be myopic in our vision. We had to have tunnel vision. We had to really expand our perspective. And the same goes with people in cryptozoology, with people in parapsychology. A lot of them are also operating by the same playbook. You know, this is my field, and to go outside of it, well, you're going to have to consult with someone else from that field. And instead, let's dump it all together and look at all the possibilities of an interconnection, a relation, you know.
That's what's happening, is more people are entering into this, is they're noticing correlations and starting to say, hey, wait a minute, let's do some more exploring and deep dive here on what's going on. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And I see it happening, you know, with a number of projects right now that people are working on, like Tim Renner and Joshua Cutchin producing Where Did the Footprints End? They just had come out with Volume 2, and about a year ago they had Volume 1. And they're really, books are primarily about Bigfoot, where do the footprints end? And they have cases where the footprints go along and then suddenly they stop.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of other things they've delved into. The paranormal and orbs and UFOs, and ghostly phenomenon connection with the Bigfoot phenomenon. And what they're doing is like what Valley did in 1969 with Passport to Magonia, you know, which shook the UFO field up, the mainstream field at the time, considerably, because, you know, suddenly here's this prominent scientist who had already written two books that were, they accepted quite easily, Anatomy of Phenomenon, Challenge to Science, because he was dealing with the UFOs. But then he got into how a lot of the sightings, landings, occupant reports, as we call them, also had characteristics to fairy lore and elementals.
Uh-huh.
And this brought in a whole different way of looking at it. And, it, you know, but now people are kind of going back to that and going beyond.
Brent Rains is editor and publisher of Alternate Perceptions magazine, online at apmagazine.info. The book that we're talking about is John Keel, The Man, the Myths, and the Ongoing Mysteries. And the cool thing about that is that those mysteries are continuing. We're going to get into more of that. Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio. Talking with Brent Rains, publisher and editor of AP Magazine, and that's Alternate Perceptions. John Keel did some fantastic work gathering this material and giving it a different perspective and saying, you know, don't take it at face value. I'm also familiar with Jacques Vallée. Now, he's still alive, but this content, I think their approach, it asks you to open your mind and try and imagine a different possibility of how this stuff might originate.
Vallée, bless his heart, he's in his 80s now and still hard at it, I'd say, and doing, you know, incredible work. That's my other hero.
Yes.
Vallée and Keel, yes.
Okay.
And Brad Steiger, he, you know.
Oh, I know. Darn it. I wasn't in the place where I could interview him. I had a phone conversation. I still have his email, he and Sherry, and they had their own experiences and their own input to add. And I think if anything about this is crucial, it helps to have some kind of an encounter or an experience so you have a better frame of reference for what other people are going through and you can ask better questions.
Actually, Brad Steiger had a book, The Aquarian Revelations, back in 1971. In that book, it told about a contactee up in Canada, in Toronto. And so in 72, you know, it was the summer and we went for a family trip. And I told my dad I wanted to look this person up, and he obliged. And I got to meet my first contactee in 72. And, you know, I interviewed him later. We actually spoke a number of times, and he was actually influenced by Keel. He had been in New York City working on one of his book projects. He was there for about a week or two. While he was there, he met with Ivan Sanderson, and Ivan Sanderson said, look, there's a gentleman by the name of John Keel. You need to meet him. So they went out and had Chinese and then went to Keel's apartment, and Keel started telling him his theories and about the men in black and the paranormal and everything, and it just opened up, you know, Brad's eyes at the time, and he began to look at, you know, things and interviewing more experiences with the perspective that Keel had brought to his attention. And pretty soon he came around to the idea that this was more complex than just nuts and bolts ETs landing and abducting and collecting soil samples and things. There was a whole high strange crossover to a lot of other areas as well. Keel really opened a lot of minds back in the 60s.
And still, because all of this information is still available, is there anybody, a contemporary, doing that kind of research that on par, and I think you're probably going to fit in that category, along with Keel, that you can think of to mention?
Well, of course, Jacques Vallée and the Free Organization, which is now CCRI, Free Organization had worked for 5 years with different academic people, and then people who really don't have an academic background like myself, but have been studying it for quite a while. And I helped with the organization, the Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Extraordinary Experiences, because there were a number of people like myself who said, we don't know for sure they're extraterrestrial. And so they added the extraordinary.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
you know, they come out with a book, Beyond UFOs, you know, because they looked at all these contact experiences. And to that book, they surveyed about 3,200. These survey forms on SurveyMonkey were like over 600 of yes and no answers, and then close to 100 where you had to fill in the details. So it was a very, very detailed survey. And, you know, the results are in Beyond UFOs. I did chapter 13, my lucky number, which was based on Marian apparitions and things and the similarities of those to UFO contact events and then a lot of the other paranormal aspects as well.
I filled out one of the surveys and I gave up after about 8 or so hours.
Yeah, they were very, 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 very detailed.
Oh, man. I did. I put it in there and said, you know what? I appreciate all that you're doing, and I know you've got plenty of content, but I'm going to stop here. Because it was very intense, and they wanted, I give them the credit because they wanted a ton of information, trying, I think, you know, to figure out what all connected and what happened to experiencers, and whether it was a spiritual thing or whether it was a UFO thing, you know, how to figure out what was going on between the two. And I tell you, in looking back at it and after talking to some of experiencers myself, I have seen correlations in my own life that I did not connect until I did more homework. And it's like, oh my gosh, here are the threads. And I mean, I knew it was there. I just didn't have a name or a context. And that's why I wanted to start with the belief is the enemy, because you go into this wide open and you have to, it takes a while before you can actually, you go in maybe with a life jacket, and then the life jacket comes off. And you have to learn how to swim, because all of a sudden you're in over your head and it's overwhelming and the experiences keep happening. When you are interviewing people, because this is one thing that you approached John Keel, I believe, in the book, you wanted to go and talk to the abductees. He gave you some advice. I like that advice.
Yeah, when I started in the UFO field, I was only 14. And it was January 1967, because I was clipping something out of the local paper at that time related to UFOs. And so I thought, anyway, it was actually these little metal balls that had been found in some country on the ground, and they couldn't identify it. But that was because I was studying UFOs, so I clipped that out of the paper, local paper. I lived up in Maine. At that time, you know, I'd read Frank Edwards' Flying Saucer Serious Business, and it was an ET theory presented to support the evidence. So that was what I was looking at. It's either ET or the Air Force was right. It was just swamp gas and weather balloons and so on. And then I began to read articles by people like John Keel, Jacques Vallée, you know, the French scientist, and they presented alternatives. You know, so it was actually in October 69 that I actually began a correspondence with Keel. None of his books had been published at that point. It was all magazine articles, Saga magazine and so on. Men's magazines is really where his articles were appearing. So I wrote to him and had my little, I had a little mimeograph newsletter on UFOs. And so I'd exchange that with a newsletter he had called Anomaly, plus actually get letters. One letter he wrote me was like 3 pages typewritten, single space.
Wow.
The whole thing, you know. And I've actually donated copies of those letters to his friend Doug Skinner, who helps to maintain a website about Keel with all kinds
of I've seen
things,
the website.
Called johnkeel.com, yeah. And so it's a great site, and so eventually when he gets around to where he needs some more material, he'll have those letters that Keel wrote me years and years ago. Uh-huh. It was in 1971, and I asked him, and I was getting interested in, I was so fascinated by all his ideas and the possibilities, I don't know that I would have stayed in the UFO field if I hadn't been for reading Keel's material and being exposed to his ideas, because, the ET thing, chasing lights in the sky and stuff, that was eventually going to get boring, I think. But now you've opened up all this other stuff. And so he recommended that, I study up on religious visionary experiences, some of the literature on that, and he recommended a book written by a parapsychologist on apparitions. And I remember at the time thinking, you know, man, this sounds like college level stuff here. Wow.
Yeah.
But finally, I had a little stint in the military for about 2 years, active duty in the Navy, that I had to do. But when I get out in 1975, I spend just about the whole summer going from Maine to Florida, making a point. The whole trip was about going around and meeting people who were researchers or experiencers to see what I could find, you know. And of course, my little checklist, I was looking for anything Keelian, you know.
Yes.
Things that Keel had found, you know. So there were a lot of very interesting stories. And about 3 years there, I was able to take a lot of trips here and there. I remember getting a call from a guy on Long Island telling me about a place down in New Jersey where they were seeing Bigfoot. So I went and spent close to a week down there. I mean, it was a great experience to to be able to do that back at the time. And so I had a number of locations where Bigfoot was being seen. And it was interesting because, you know, in these different states, there were people seeing Bigfoot, but they were also seeing balls of light, flying saucers. You know, there was poltergeist phenomena breaking up different places. So, I mean, it was just like I had read in, you know, Keel's material.
Brent Rains. With John Keel as a mentor, he got some great advice. So what happened with that? Where did he go with that? Well, that's what Alternate Perceptions magazine online is all about. Tons of content. Going to get back to the book and what it's about. John Keel. Wendy's Coffeehouse, KCMO Talk Radio.
In my book on John Keel, I mean, I'd written two previous books, but it finally dawned on me, you know, I want to show the influence he had on me and describe the cases I came across, tell some about his life, and also interview other people who were influenced by Keel.
Wendy's Coffee House with Brent Rains. You found other people who knew Keel. Who did you start with?
One of them was longtime ufologist Tim Beckley, who some people call Mr. UFO.
Mm-hmm.
He's done different magazines, published lots of books. He's been in it since the late 50s. And he did an interview with Keel back around 78, I believe, that he published in one of his magazines back then called UFO Review. It was a great interview because Keel was talking about experiences he had as a young person that no doubt influenced him. He knew from the beginning that this UFO paranormal stuff is real because he had already experienced, like when he was age 7, seeing a big barn-sized sphere of light raise up from the top of a hill.
Yeah.
And he had a poltergeist activity at his grandparents' farm where he was staying, where there was a knocking sound on the wall and he'd knocked back and he tried to come up with some kind of a code. And when he was 10, there was a gorilla type thing that was scaring people at a farm nearby and was crossing the road, and the farmers got their shotguns out and went trying to look for it. And then the encounters disappeared just as mysteriously as they had started, you know. And so, you know, his first book was Strange Creatures from Time and Space, and it was all about Bigfoot and the Mothman of West Virginia and things. So
mm-hmm.
He got his early start in cryptozoology when he was only 10. He went to New York City, I think, when he was 17. He hitchhiked to New York City. He knew at that time, because he'd been writing for a local newspaper for about 2 years, that was the career he wanted to pursue. And so with only like 75 cents in his pockets and a bunch of his belongings, he headed for, you know, New York City, because he thought that's where he could make his mark in the literary world. And he was staying at some little apartment off of Times Square when he was, I think it was 19 or 20. He claimed that he had one of those peak experiences, or what you call cosmic consciousness. Suddenly, there was a strange glow in his room, and he suddenly knew the answers to everything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But like other people had that experience later on the next day, he could only remember fragments of what he knew at the time of the experience with this beautiful light. And he figured that there had been something downloaded. And if there was a download, I guess it was for later when he would be involved in this other stuff.
I have a question. There's a part in here, Håkan Blom, is it Blomqvist? How do you pronounce his name? He's also a researcher, UFO researcher.
Oh, yeah, Håkan Blomqvist, Swedish researcher.
Yes, and I've read his stuff, too. He's prolific. He said that he got an autographed copy of Operation Trojan Horse, and in it he says, the secret to UFOs is on page 321, all right? So the last page in the book is 320.
Yes, I love it.
That's the humor again.
That's the humor, yeah. Keel actually visited Sweden in 1978 and visited Håkan Blomqvist's apartment for two nights where other friends of his in the UFO field would gather, and they would just chat with Keel and discuss different cases and stuff. And what a rare opportunity. And they even had a birthday cake for Keel, because it was around his birthday while, you know, he was over there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a picture of him eating his cake.
Yeah, you have your cake and eat it too. Okay, I want to get back into your content, though, with the magazine. When I was a kid, I read Fate. Now I read your magazine because, and I wish I had more time because I'm so busy trying to glean all the content to continue doing interviews, that when I want to go and do a deep dive, I'll just check on one of your articles. The latest one was a little citing the miniature UFO inside a Nashville home. And then there's others on here. The advent of flying saucers, drive-in theater UFO encounter, multiple witness case UFOs. These are tall humanoid beings in Russia. Encounters with the unknown, devilish little man again. These are all from the current, the February.
And also on that, there's a Klaus Svahn, who is a journalist over in Sweden. He's been in the studying UFOs for over 40 years. He works for a major newspaper over there. We've got an audio interview with him, and he's also a good friend of Hakan Blankovic. You know, and I asked him, in the interview, he was telling about this case involving a little man that someone had seen a couple of years earlier. So I asked if he could, you know, send us that. So that's one of the articles, a written article that we have in there, a little elf man sighting in Sweden, where he actually interviewed the guy himself. The drive-in encounter was from 1974 at Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. And I was going there a number of times in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
And there was so much activity in that area. And I didn't know about this case until recently. So that had special interest to me because, it was only where that theater is and where I was visiting this house of Madeline Teagle, who was a contact experiencer. And also people would gather to do sky watches and meditations and just shoot the bull. Mm-hmm. And so I'd go there on weekends because she'd have all these gatherings. I met a lot of contact experiences through her and people with extraordinary sightings and things.
I was going to ask real quick, though, Native American, because there's a Native American connection with that.
Yeah. Madeline herself was had some Iroquois and she had informed me about a contact experience. He was a Native American medicine man over in Pennsylvania. So I made it a point to correspond and actually met him twice, visited his home, he and his wife. His name was Chief Wife, what people called him, and his wife was Sweet Deer. And she was Native American, too. And so, Native American is an area that I've explored as much as I could. We even used to have a sweat lodge behind our house here in Tennessee, thinking about rebuilding it sometime. We've got we've had such an interest. We've even got a collection of the Peruvian whistling vessels, which were pre-Columbian, but we've got replicas of them, and they produce, you know, the same type sounds, and they have, you know, their effigy vessels, which have different, you know, you have some that are animal form. One of them is like a person that seems to be in a state of prayer. They've got their hands folded in front of them and their eyes closed, and a lot of people report, you know, I've actually done different presentations and talks for those, and we've had people who, like, enter an altered state when these whistles are blown. It seems to be maybe like a binaural beat type thing, like with the Monroe Institute with Bob Monroe, who actually developed audio recordings that have this binaural beat to enter altered states and maybe have out-of-the-body excursions. What we have is people who sometimes report out of the body or visionary type stuff, or seeing, you know, and sometimes a person may see something that, or experience something that corresponds to someone else in the room or within the group. I actually had about 7 vessels at one time, and we're out on a pontoon in the lake over in Memphis, visiting with Dr. Gregory Little, and he's a Memphis psychologist. He's very interested in Native American Indian mounds and earthworks. In fact, he wrote an encyclopedia on the subject, which has gone into second edition, and he's also studied up on Jungian psychology and UFOs and paranormal, all sorts of the same areas. We worked together on alternate perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we had a gathering back, I think around 2006 one day. Andrew Collins from England was there, frequently a guest on Ancient Aliens, and he's written quite a number of books and very familiar with shamanism and things, and he thought the whistling vessels were very powerful shamanic tools. We were all out there in the lake. Myself, Greg, Andrew, and another person all had this vision while we were blowing the whistles of a vortex, a spinning vortex. And as we talked further later afterwards, we discovered by coincidence we all saw the vortex spinning in the same direction. That's not the first time that sort of thing has happened in other cases.
And you've heard the phrase, there's no such thing as coincidence. Back after a break. Wendy's Coffee House. Wendy's Coffee House. Okay, a quick recap. We were in the middle of a shamanic experience where these guys all saw a vortex unknowingly.
They all saw it turning the same direction, and they were using Peruvian whistles, all right? So just to catch up there.
Andrew was excited and said, you know, really, you need to have get a group together and do this regularly and see if, like, you can go into the vortex or something and from there spin out and go into another direction to explore some shamanic type realm.
Brent Rains, publisher and editor of Alternate Perceptions magazine and author of John Keel, The Man, The Myths, and The Ongoing Mysteries.
And I've noticed that doing it, that people who are experiencers, some of whom were contact experiences. I had one experience with Betty Adrian Luker, one of the most famous contact abduction experiences, written up in several books by Raymond Fowler.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in this room over at the ARE in Virginia Beach, Virginia, the Edgar Casey organization. And I had four of the vessels, Peruvian whistles, and positioned in kind of like best I could, the four corners of this big auditorium. And we had the whistles blown, and her experience was so profound that she sent me a sketch of it, which I framed afterwards. It was of this large conical stone with like a giant hawk standing behind it, and a ring of fire at the base of this stone, and some kind of writing at the bottom on the ground that I've never had gotten a translation of, but I've always wondered about. You know, she saw all this in a vision, all of this was being blown. She was, I think, about 20 or 30 feet from the nearest person that was blowing the whistle, but it had quite a powerful effect on her. One woman was a contact experiencer up in the Nashville area, and she, this was a different session. This was actually done in the Nashville area, and afterwards she had to drive home, and when she got home, it was like everything was splitting into two images,
mm-hmm.
and she was afraid when she was driving into a driveway that she might misjudge and land up on her lawn. And one of the people present claimed he saw an alien by her car before she drove off. And, I mean, it had been about an hour from the time that we blew the whistles before she left. So I'd never had anybody that was affected that way. It was kind of disturbing. So I try to make sure that everybody is, as best we can after we do that, that they wait a while before they, you know, drive use machinery or anything.
Well, even then, though, it could be a trigger where it doesn't have to happen at that moment. You've just basically pulled the trigger, all right? So if it's going to cue somebody, then that will happen. And I don't know if that's controllable, because once you've done that, it's like hitting the proper tone, and then the sequence is a cascade effect where then somebody opens up like a flower. You know, there's one leaf, another leaf, but all you did was hit that proper tone and the key, and that unlocked Pandora's box for the most part. You know, I'm kind of taking that, you know, embellishing a little bit, but I do think those tones are a trigger. And my question is, do you have that on audio recording anywhere?
I'm not the only one. There are audio recordings out there of the whistles.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the original researchers of that, Daniel Stachinoff, who first discovered this psychoacoustical property, as he called it, back in 72, when he blew one of the whistles and had an experience like he was out of the body.
What was the name again?
Daniel Stachinoff, Stachenko, or something like that.
Okay. Close enough. Yeah.
and you know, you can find him on the internet. You can key in Peruvian whistling vessels, and he used to make these replicas, as well as a gentleman that he became acquainted with in the 1980s in Boston College in New England, who was studying psychotherapy, was interested in different religious practices for inducing altered consciousness, and the professor told him about, hey, you need to study the Peruvian whistles, and so he went to a gathering, and he had a profound experience, saw things, and at one point he was sitting there contemplating what he'd experienced earlier, and then suddenly this big black panther entered the room, and he was found himself alone in the room except him and this, well, actually like a jaguar. He didn't realize that the jaguar had anything to do with Peru,
yes,
or you know, the origin of these whistles, and And he thought he was actually having a real experience instead of a vision until he got up and he kept trying to put, you know, a couch or something in between him and the jaguar until he could find a door to get out of the room.
Don't eat me. Don't eat me. No, 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 no.
So he got home and he wrote, before the sun came up, I think about 30 pages of everything he could remember about that night.
Okay, yeah. These are like triggers.
Yeah, in fact, Jonathan Goldman is a sound therapist out in Colorado, and I interviewed him, and I talked about the whistles, and he does this week-long program in the summers, you know, in Colorado for, you know, maybe not this past year because of COVID, but anyway, he said he always waited till the very end after they'd done everything else, the toning and the bells and things, and then he'll introduce the proving whistles, he said, because they're so powerful that it's best to gradually build up to it.
Yeah.
As opposed to the way I usually do it.
Just dive right in. It's like, okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. We have to wrap, but I want to, again, Alternate Perceptions is the magazine, and it's apmagazine.info. And, you know, you have so much content on there that there's no time to really, you know, go a quick overview. But what do you want to add for people who are just, if, you know, they're just now finding you or would like to research a little more along this line?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, Brent Raines. And then I have a page on Facebook called Alternate Perceptions. And then, of course, Alternate Perceptions, the online magazine, comes out the first of each month. We archive each issue. And so, you know, you've got the current issue that you can go to and you can see all the things up at the top. You can also go to back issues and read the content there. We try to have at least one interview with somebody with interesting things to share, either an experiencer or a researcher or maybe both in each issue. And, of course, we have, as you said, a variety of things. In fact, Fate Magazine, you mentioned Fate Magazine, that was actually our goal, me and Greg's goal in the beginning, was to have something where you had a variety of things. So maybe one thing didn't interest you, then maybe you skipped another article, and that might be something more in line. Because we both felt that they were all potentially interrelated, so we were happy with everything we could get.
Well, I think that's perfect. I mean, because it is. You enter one door, and all of a sudden you find out you're in a castle with rooms. They would say many mansions. Yes. Okay, there you go. Brent Raines, I really appreciate your content. I'm so thrilled that you guys have so many areas that you cover, because I think that's important. I think that, you know, once you take one little, I'm not going to say a pill, I'll say a potato chip, then you're ready for a little bit more and a little bit more. And don't go with the Peruvian whistles until very, very, very end, right?
Right.
Save those for the nightcap, maybe, or the kicker. And sound is incredible. When you're around those things, some of those can be hidden cues or triggers. And just be aware of that, because you never know when you're going to connect.
Something I kind of get lost in, too, and talking about this is the EVP stuff as well. I had dabbled some in trying to do EVPs and thought maybe a time to use it. Usually I was the one debunking EVPs. And then when I got John Keel coming to EVP, that, you know, after his passing, well,
okay.
That was high strangeness for me.
Okay, you want to talk about the EVP there with John Keel?
If you want to.
So there's going to have to be another show, because we're out of time. I'll give you one sample right now. I'll play it twice, and you'll hear Brent's voice for comparison.
John Keel.
An example of the EVP. So since we didn't go there this time, we'll do another segment with EVPs. I'll post some links on Audioboom and WendysCoffeehouse.com.
The book John Keel, The Man, the Myths, and the Ongoing Mysteries, and that's Brent's book. There are so many stories in there that give you a chance to explore the possibilities and the potentials we have here that we don't often get a chance to do, unless there's something like COVID that comes along and forces you into lockdown, and you've got to go, well, what else is here that I haven't had a chance to look at? What do you think about that?
That's right. It's an opportunity to open other doors.
Yeah. APmagazine.info, that's the website. And thank you for listening. Whatever you're doing, wherever you are, there's so much here we have yet to discover and explore. Stay curious.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.